Is as close to an ideal gas as you kind of want. It's a single nucleus, and it doesn't really, as you said, it doesn't have much in a vibrational energy or a rotational energy. When I was talking about the different forms of kinetic energy, I was talking of the less ideal gases, carbon chains and all kinds of things, where you have a lot of rotation around the bonds, and you have vibration, springiness between the bonds of the covalent bonds of the gas, if it's, you know, methane or ethane or something like that. So I was kind of talking more of a more complex non-ideal gas type of structure, in which the translational kinetic energy is one portion, but then there's also this kind of collection of rotational and vibrational energy that doesn't really directly introduce a temperature increase, and that's one aspect of why some materials have a slightly different specific heat than others, because some of the kinetic energy, rather than going into translational, is going into non-translational form.
And WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, there's one company, it's called Spin Launch, and they're developing a system where the this payload is literally spun, you know, at very high rates of speed, and he thinks he can get this off the ground to a speed of around 3,000 miles per hour. So if he uses it as a, not the first stage, but a second stage, be able to get heavy payloads, it would save a tremendous amount of energy. This guy's actually building this thing. It's Jonathan Yannon, CEO of Spin Launch. It's quite a story. I mean, he's got hardware and everything. But he hasn't tested anything yet, but he's working on it.
If I understand you correctly, Paul, does he believe he can get thrust out of spinning some material that's on board this rocket ship? Go ahead.
No, but, I'm wondering about the article. I haven't seen the August issue yet. I'm wondering if they bring up something besides just getting thrust. This guy plans on spinning something so fast, that momentum, and then you release it, and that would fly into space and get this long, thin projectile, able to cut through the atmosphere. And he thinks he can get a couple of thousand, up to 3,000 pounds, I think he's looking to do for payload. But to start, it would work great on the moon. It would, from the moon's surface itself. But for now, he wants to use it as a second stage. But no, you're not going to get thrust out of it, but it's a way to get something moving without thrust, without a chemical reaction at all, just a spinning action.
So after the spinning action, is he then using it as a kind of accelerator, and it ultimately becomes a gun which is throwing these chunks of matter into space? Is it a kind of a gun, Paul?
Yeah, maybe I'll send it over to Roy's website. I can show you the rocket itself, but I don't see the spinning thing. No, it's going to spin, I don't see that yet. I do see his rocket. It looks like a very thin, long black missile with a very sharp point. But it really is like a Wile E. Coyote type of thing, like the old cartoons. In fact, as my notes, I pasted Wile E. Coyote to remind me to bring it up. But I never did. This was a few weeks ago, but I never got to it. Back to you, Dick.
Tony B2 GXM. GXM, go ahead.
K2RW in the group, WB2 GXM. They are planning to use this kind of momentum drive to move small modules around an asteroid. They're going to spin up interior flywheels and then break them suddenly. And when they break the flywheel, the momentum is going to flip the module around on the surface of the asteroid, and it will move the module without using any propellant. And the gravitational force of the asteroid will keep these things from flying away, WB2GXM.
Wild stuff, Rich. Let me pass it back to Roy. So we really got to find some kind of a thrusting engine that doesn't use the material that it throws away, if you know what I mean. AC2GS, K2RIW, do you have any faith in any of these systems so far, Roy?
Who knows? I mean, it ends up being a crapshoot, but I could see where conservation of momentum, you know, momentum can be converted into kinetic energy. The problem then becomes the energy storage that's used to speed up the angular momentum to make it run. That's going to expend energy. Not necessarily a propellant mass, but energy. So is that going to be nuclear? Is it going to be solar? How are you going to get that energy into that system for a long haul?
NY2H. Lou, are you on frequency? K2RIW?
NY2H.
I think you guys have made some changes to the repeater recently. Master 3 or something like that. I've noticed that Roy no longer has any speech dropout. Whatever change you made, it's good. Over to you, Lou.
Well, yeah, there's a temporary system in place right now. It's another Master 3. The guys have been up there and retuned the duplexer and a number of things, so... we're actually working a different system right now. Then we're going to go back to the old system again in a little while when it's put together on someone's bench first. So, all right, yeah, that's an interesting observation. I don't know if we'll ever get to the bottom of it, but, yeah.
Very fine, Lou. We're making progress. Hey, Roy, you no longer have had any dropout of your speech. You've got it, Roy.
Very good. I'm glad to hear that someone removed the AC2GS filter on the repeater.
You're no longer being filtered. You now go straight through.
Very good. Very good. Any other comments or questions, Dick?
Not for me. You got the floor.
As always, I like to remind people that if you have any questions or topics or you just want to refute anything I said, feel perfectly free. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@alphacharlie2golfsierra.com, my call sign. Everything that I talk about will have a link to my webpage, which is roy.ac2gs.com. Not only the stories that I talk about tonight, but I also will post a nice little reference work on dipoles that are odd multiples of half waves and what the radiation pattern looks like for those people not familiar with cucumbers, I guess. So that's something to look forward to. So let me drop for a second. If anyone has any other kind of topics or questions they'd like to ask before I do my thing, this is the time. Feel free.
Intuition.
Yes, Wesley.
Question to you. Do you think that we should go to the... Is that what I emailed to you and Dick?
As I emailed you back, Wesley, we sort of have touched upon this in before. We've talked about the TM modes. I think you mentioned you discussed it with Dick for a couple of weeks recently. We talked about Zenek waves, which I still think are more theoretical than real, and other aspects. And we talked about that organization, that company in Texas, that seems to be building a Tesla tower and trying to fulfill Tesla's dream. I still don't really see any facts available yet, and I would like personally to wait until these guys actually prove anything that they're suggesting that they've already secretly proved, but they're not willing to show anyone. I think that's reasonable.
Okay. Do you think that it would be good if I give a little bit brief about it? And eventually, Dick, did you have the chance to read my email?
Yes, I did. And when it comes to TM wave, they use the word TM wave when using a local effect of a conductor. I can't remember the exact wording of it. So a TM wave in free space with no other local material nearby doesn't really propagate. And of a slightly similar nature, there were at the tail end of Ham Radio Magazine, near the end of its use, I think it was Ham Radio Magazine, they were talking about a kind of wave that has a longitudinal wave, where a substantial amount of either the E or the H is in the direction of propagation, and they were thinking that they could set this up with a feed horn-like structure and propagate that into free space. And I'm very skeptical. I think they were making more errors than reality. So radio waves without other structures nearby, only TEM exists, is what I keep finding. Back to you for any rebuttal on that one, Wes. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Well, first of all, longitudinal wave doesn't exist in the transversal Hertzian-like waves. The thing is that in little of history, let me drop. In 1986, Dr. Quorum was pretty much known, and he had a number of investigations in the area of Tesla coil. And then, all of a sudden, in 2014, he decided that he's going to repeat Seneca Lake experiment that was done in 1934. And he came to the conclusion that there was an error in equation, and that Gobau, first found about the Zenex wave in 1908, was right. Let's see. And then in 2015, Chevron, which is oil company, thinking to avoid competition in run for new technology, decided to send a number of scientists and eventually check what Quorum Brothers are about. That was after Seneca Lake experiment. And then they decided that they're going to invest money in new Tesla tower in Texas. But it was they didn't have money at that time. In 2016, they, based on that information that I have, they found money for land and the tower, and it was about a little bit more than $500 million. In 2016, military and government was activated in their own applications. Dr. Quorum, based on his bio, you can look at, he had been working in Department of Defense programs for a long period of time, in DARPA programs as well. In 2017, they've got plenty of money. The patent, as simple as a paperclip, is about $20,000. As Dr. Roy was mentioning, if you have a lump amount of patents, it becomes cheaper. But they've been filing the patent application every 2 weeks. Now they have hundreds of patents, all of them in the same area. In 2018, they finished, at the end of the year, they finished the Tesla Tower. They were supposed to send electrical energy around the world with almost no losses. And now I'm going to put the percentage on it, which is going to be controversial. 92 to 98% of signal goes through, and only a few percent is the losses. In 2019, they've got about 20 patents till now, and those are in areas of anything that you can imagine. It's not about the electrical energy only and longer, but it is about communication, geolocation, individual person tracking, switching on and off devices remotely anywhere in the world, and internet and telephony. And they filed a patent application about modulation of the Zenek wave. So far, in the official statement that they have made and was on video, they said that Tesla Tower is operational, and the first overseas sending energy will be done till the end of the year. Now, how much is that true, how much is not, is the matter of opinion, but I would like to have your opinion on it.
Anytime you send any electromagnetic energy into the air, it's going to obey the inverse square law. Every time you double the distance, you get one quarter the amount of energy transmitted from point A to point B. I think the main thrust of what we're looking at here with all these patents and your interest in this is the ability to send power through the air wirelessly.
No, it is not. It is sending electrical energy through the interface. The interface is air-earth, 2D, two-dimensional structure, when we say, where the interface is where the Zenek wave, which is the surface wave, exists. And they are made in every possible patent repeatedly the explanation of how it works, and then they, in the second part of each patent, they went to what this patent is about. So in other words, is you have a Tesla coil, let me drop.
Wait a minute now. Apparently, I used the wrong word. I said sending power through the air. I just said, maybe I should say sending power wirelessly.
It is not wirelessly. Maybe it is. If you call the surface wave, which is the wave that is trapped in the interface between air and earth, if you call it wirelessly, then yes, we might say that you're right.
Okay, as you can tell, I'm very skeptical. Roy is very skeptical. I don't care if there's a million patents issued. To send energy through what looks to a human eye like empty space, and yes, maybe it's really, we're using the ionosphere and whatever, to send power through that medium, until they really do it and prove that it is economically feasible, economically possible, I'm skeptical and disinterested. And I think it's a subject right now, it's got a whole lot of theory, a whole lot of patents, not very much real confirmation experiments. Therefore, I'm not in favor of spending much time discussing it now. I think the problem, Wes, is that you get quite deep into subjects that are fascinating to you, and unfortunately Roy and I get mail from people who say they don't want to hear that kind of material. I'm sorry to hear it, but I'm sorry to say that, but there are people who give us flack, saying that until it's really proven to work, they don't want to hear it. It's too theoretical for them. Back to you, Wes, and maybe not now. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
No, I understand this perfectly. I accept it. Thank you very much.
Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. Thank you, Wesley. And, you know, if they actually pull off these experimental proofs and demonstrate it, then I'm sure everyone is going to want to know all the details. So just, you know, put it on your calendar, and once they've proved stuff, then it's probably a good idea. But as a theory, we've kind of gone over it a few times. So anyone else with any questions or comments at this time before I go through my usual spiel? You know, going to try to kind of fathom a little bit more math and see if anyone's interested. Now, back in the 4th century, before the Common Era, a Greek philosopher called Zeno of Elea annoyed his fellow Greek philosophers with a set of paradoxes. His underlying premise appeared to be that to show that motion is nothing but an illusion. As the story comes down from antiquity, another Greek philosopher with the great name Diogenes the Skeptic tried to refute Zeno's argument that motion is an illusion by standing up and quietly walking away, using his particular motion, sparing himself from the rest of Zeno's presentation. We have nothing written directly by Zeno. Instead, we have secondhand writings from people like Plato and others regarding these paradoxes of Zeno. The simplest version for me is the paradox of Achilles and the tortoise. For the sake of this example, I will supply rates and distances just simply to allow anyone who wants to do the math in his head to do the math in his head. They're not really appropriate for either Achilles or the tortoise. Let me drop for a second. Okay. Say Achilles and a tortoise have a race. Achilles is twice as fast as the tortoise. So he gives the tortoise a 1 mile lead before Achilles even begins his race. Let's say Achilles travels at 1 mile a minute, and while the tortoise races at about a half a mile a minute. At the end of the first minute, Achilles has reached the place where the tortoise was when Achilles first began racing after the tortoise. It was given the 1 mile lead. But in that time, the tortoise has continued to move another half mile farther. So Achilles continues racing after the ever-moving tortoise. After another half second, Achilles has reached 1.5 mile distance, but the tortoise is now 1/4 mile farther than Achilles is. And so it goes. Achilles continues to divide the distance between himself. 1/8 mile, 1/16 mile, 1/32 mile, 1/64 mile, growing smaller and smaller, but never actually equaling zero. And so he never actually reaches the tortoise. The premise being, if you divide your path by an infinite number of intervals, all of which require some short but greater than zero time to traverse them, how do you get to the other side? Or, as Zeno said, is motion an illusion? Anyone with any ideas? I realize math is not the greatest thing sometimes, but, you know, indulge me. Is it possible to look upon this paradox with any kind of meaning? If you divide up the path that you take from where you're sitting now to the door of your room into an infinite number of distances with a non-zero time to traverse them, do you never reach the end of your room and get out of your shack?
VDH for the comic.
Yes, John. And belated happy birthday.
Huh? Oh, okay. Anyway, well, if you keep cutting the distances in half, I know in the limit you'll reach it. It becomes a half, a geometric series, a half, a quarter, an eighth, a sixteenth, which adds up to the whole distance. Go ahead.
Okay, so different people kind of use different things to explain that. It is, your explanation is some kind of something in the middle of in the 16th century. Leibniz and Newton co-invented one in Germany, one in England, a calculus, which includes integration. And they used integration to sort of demonstrate what you said, that If you divide things in half perpetually, rather than an infinite series, it confines itself to a finite answer. So I guess that's what you're saying. There's another way of solving it, which kind of you also mentioned. There are different things that there are series. 1 + 1/2 plus 1/4 plus 1/8 plus 1/16, and it goes on and on to infinity, has an infinite number of terms in the series. But if you take out a pencil or pen, you can pretty much figure out that the equation 1 + 1/2 plus 1/4 plus 1/8 plus 1/16 actually resolves to 2. And there's an algebraic way of doing it, which is simply to divide that number by 2 on both sides, subtract that number from the original, and you end up with the sum equaling 2. So the point is that it was a fallacy of Zeno's you could have infinite terms, but just because you have infinite terms doesn't mean that you have an infinite number. And as an example, all the irrational numbers that we talked about a few weeks ago, pi, Euler's constant, the square root of 2, it's a never-ending number. It just goes on and on and on, but although it has an infinite number of terms to it, it's a finite number. The square root of 2 is the square root of 2. There's nothing infinite about it. So that's the kind of solution to the fallacy of Zeno's paradox. Let me drop for a sec. The strange thing, at least for me, is that apparently there is a construct known as Zeno's quantum paradox, which unfortunately seems to not be a fallacy. There are some systems in which if you keep measuring for a random probability of something happening, in some cases the probability gets less, and some things never happen. It's kind of like in the quantum realm, in some cases a watched pot never does boil. And then there's something called the anti-Zeno quantum effect, in which for some probabilities, repeatedly, constantly measuring it causes the probability of it to happen gets greater. So that's the exact opposite. It brings it on. So I just thought people might be interested in Zeno's paradox. It's been around for about 2,500 years, and people are still trying to figure it out. Some people think that they have the answer either in calculus or in set theory and series. The equation 1 + 1/2 + 1/4 + 1/8 on and on and on is called a convergence series because the answer converges to a finite number. If, on the other hand, you had a series like 1 + 1/2 + 1/3 + 1/4 + 1/5, that would be a divergent series that would go on and on into infinity itself. So that's my little spiel about Zeno's paradox. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
There's a little bit of a joke you've probably heard. Maybe it's inappropriate, but I'll give it to you anyhow. Way back in the days when they used to consider Raquel Welch a very pretty lady, a person was told that she's on one end of the room and the man of interest is on the other end of the room, and you keep halving the distance between the two. But you get closer and closer, but never really get there. But a practical engineer will say, in a very short period of time, I get close enough for all practical purposes. How are you, Roy? KQRIW.
Very good, Dick. And I don't think that was inappropriate in the slightest. And she still is a striking woman, actually. But yeah, Zeno's paradox has been reframed and reworded repeatedly for the last 2,500 years and probably for the next 2,500 years. Okay, on with the next. I hate to suggest this, but I really think that Elon Musk is starting to believe his public relations. Last Tuesday evening in San Francisco, SpaceX and Tesla CEO Elon Musk finally shed some light on what Neuralink is, a company that's raised $158 million to develop a ultra-high bandwidth brain machine interface to connect humans and computers. has been up to since its launch in 2017. In the live-streamed announcement, Musk expressed his long-held concern that humans would be left behind by developments in artificial intelligence, but said with the development of a true brain-computer interface, humanity could come along for the ride. He described the principal barrier preventing this as an information precision and bandwidth issue with existing technology that interfaces with the brain limited in both. To that end, Neuralink says it has developed a new way of embedding electrodes into the brain using tiny insulated threads that resemble a string of pearls and connect to a chip embedded in the skull. Those threads are designed to be both sturdy enough to pass through the brain tissue and withstand degradation, according to the company, while also being flexible enough to not damage tissue when the brain shifts in the skull. That could, and it's a big could, be a significant advance over current methods that use needle-like electrodes that can be risky to insert or offer degrading performances over time. Neuralink said that the threads are extremely thin, 4 to 6 micrometers, smaller than the diameter of a human hair. The abstract of a white paper credited to Elon Musk at Neuralink, which has not yet been peer-reviewed, says that the system could support as many as 3,072 electrodes per array distributed across 96 threads. Let me drop for a second. Because these things are so thin and flexible, the idea is that they move with tissue instead of tearing the tissue, Neuralink researcher Philip Sabas told Bloomberg. In the presentation, Neuralink described plans for an external receiver that could wirelessly communicate with the embedded chip and connect to apps, though it currently relies on a hardwired external connection. Right now, you would need a USB-C connector to plug into your friend's brain. Neuralink also debuted a surgical robot equipped with advanced optics that it says is precise enough to weave the delicate threads throughout the brain tissue without damaging blood vessels. The research paper said that the system is capable of inserting 6 threads, that's 192 electrodes, per minute, The Verge wrote. According to Bloomberg, Neuralink also wrote that it had used the robot to perform at least 19 surgeries on animals with a success rate of 87%. It does, of course, require a brain surgeon to actually operate the machine. Neuralink's aim is to eventually make the process as simple as a LASIK outpatient eye surgery. Musk told the audience that goal is not a short-term one, according to the New York Times. Neuralink president Max Hodak said the technique currently requires general anesthesia and drilling a series of holes through the skull, so they eventually hope to switch to lasers and switch to local anesthesia. One of the big bottlenecks is that mechanical drill couples vibration through the skull, which is, what they say, unpleasant, whereas a laser drill, you wouldn't feel, Hodak told the Times. While the Neuralink officials acknowledge to the Times that they have a long way to go before their technique will have practical application, Musk wants to start human testing of this system as early as next year. But the company hasn't started the process of obtaining approval for such tests from the Food and Drug Administration, which has somewhat high barriers for human trials. Let me drop for a second. The Times reported that during a demo at the Neuralink building on Tuesday, the company showed off what it said was the system connected to a laboratory rat reading information from 1,500 electrodes, 15 times better than current systems embedded in humans. If successfully applied to humans, that would be sufficient for research and medical applications, the Times wrote, though it notes that many more steps will be necessary to demonstrate its utility. Independent scientists caution that the results from the laboratory animals might not translate into human success, and that human trials would be required to determine the technology's promise. The flexibility of the Neuralink threads would be an advance, said Terry Stejanovsky, the Francis Crick professor at Salk Institute for Biological Studies in La Jolla, California. However, he noted that the Neuralink researchers still needed to prove that the insulation of their threads could survive for long periods in the brain's environment, which has a salt solution that deteriorates many plastics. There are numerous other reasons to be cautious. Musk is well known for making big promises that often fail to pan out and offering up ambitious timetables for grandiose projects that have been attracting labels like Messianic Huckster, the best used car salesman on Earth, and the world's most annoying BSer. Neuralink claims are all but certain to attract a great deal of scientific scrutiny in the coming days. According to the Wall Street Journal, Neuralink's research paper has not yet been peer-reviewed, as well as lacks critical data on how well it functions over time or whether it can cause brain inflammation. Let me drop for a second.
Yeah, when you get a chance, I'm going to have two questions for you, Roy. Go ahead.
Okay, very well. The paper, which wasn't peer-reviewed, didn't include data on the long-term stability of recorded neural signals, nor the brain's inflammatory response. The Neuralink has said it's doing these experiments, but isn't ready to make the data public. Tim Harris, a senior fellow at Howard Hughes Medical Institute's Janela Research Campus and neural interface developer, told the paper that the system needs to be able to last at least 5 years in the brain to be worth implanting in humans. The journal noted that while Neuralink says that the system was, in theory, designed to stimulate brain cells, a major next step, the paper says, we have not demonstrated these capabilities quite yet. Control Lab investor and Lux Capital co-founder and managing partner Joshua Wolf also told the journal that his company is currently developing much less invasive external sensor-based methods, adding that there is no way I'm thinking about technology that involves drilling holes behind ears right now. According to Bloomberg, Neuralink will also have to demonstrate not only that the implants function, but that it can do something safe and useful with them by providing therapies, something many scientists see as an open question. For example, actually decoding nerve pulses and translating them into usable information is a daunting task. Researchers have already developed brain-computer interfaces like BrainGate, which has been used for limited control of computers and robot arms, as well as developed ways to stimulate nerves involved in hearing and vision. But anything more sophisticated than these simple input or output technologies remains purely in the realm of science fiction. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
As I said, I've got two questions on this one, Roy. The easiest question to ask, do you believe Elon Musk has people who will volunteer for this, let me call it an experiment? In the case of going to Mars, for instance, there were people who volunteered for that possible mission. When it comes to holes drilled in the head to add wires in order to be able to read brain waves externally, that's what I think is going on here. Are there really volunteers for that? And even if a person is foolish enough to volunteer, would the FDA let them do it? That's question number one. Over to you, Roy.
Well, kind of knowing how my fellow man's mind works to a degree, I think that there is definitely people who would volunteer for this. I would have my doubts about their stability. But I think you could find people. I do not, though, think that the people manning the FDA in their wildest imagination are going to approve that before a lot of other work gets done. So I say, yeah, there are guys out there who will volunteer to have holes drilled in their head. There are guys who do this to themselves occasionally. There's a whole bunch of mentally ill people who have decided that their brain needs more oxygen, and so they try to drill holes in their skull. But I don't think the FDA is going to go for it. It's going to be another one of these things like the Bohr program, where he was going to run some kind of machine that efficiently and cheaply bore tunnels into the earth.
Okay, question number two now is a little bit deeper. And by way of you being an active physician, and therefore you have a lot more anatomy knowledge than most of us have, I've got a series of questions about the so-called blood-brain barrier. My understanding is that the blood of a human being, by way of the carotid artery, gets up to the area of the brain but does not directly go there. There's a barrier that materials in the blood have to go through before it really gets to the neurons of the brain. I may be wrong, but I've got a mental picture of that being sort of like a placenta. where there's two separate blood circulations, but I know there's no separate heart inside the brain, so that must be wrong. When we talk about the blood-brain barrier, where certain things can't easily get there, certain kinds of medication won't go to the brain because it won't go through the blood-brain barrier. Obviously, I'm very vague as to what that is. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW. And he has to bridge that in order to put in these wires, if I understand correctly. Over to you, Roy.
Actually, he doesn't. It's all electronic. Basically, what he has to do is make sure he doesn't puncture any of the circulatory vessels in the brain when he's introducing his needles. But they're conductive needles, and they apply a small voltage potential, and they read the local voltage potential. So you don't have to worry for this particular problem about the blood-brain barrier. For all intents and purposes, most organs sort of work in the same general way. You have arteries which supply the blood. They branch off into arterioles, smaller arteries, until they branch to something just about a little bit above the diameter of a red blood cell, capillaries. And those capillaries are lined with different things. In the brain, the capillaries are lined to have a tighter kind of fit, where there's a little bit less leakage and variability of what gets through it. So there are some compounds that are simply too big to pass the pores of the capillary, and that's where the blood-brain barrier type of concept comes from. But there's no heart in there. It's the same arteries to arterioles to capillaries to venules to veins. Same circulatory system. There's a slight difference in what's lining the capillaries there.
Okay, if I take a simplistic approach here, if the capillaries are approximately the size of a red corpuscle, as long as the individual particles of my pharmaceutical that I wish to introduce to that brain, as long as the individual particles are smaller than a red corpuscle, does that mean they will not be inhibited by the so-called blood-brain barrier? Over to you, Roy.
A word, no. It's kind of like a tube that the diameter, the inner diameter of the tube lets red blood cells go one at a time. It also, though, has pores in it. So it's the much smaller openings, incredibly smaller than the diameter of a red blood cell, where material gets exchanged. Some through capillary action, some through active channels, through different mechanisms. But it's the porosity of the material surrounding the capillary tube that allows things to traverse that layer, as opposed to the red blood cells that are just getting pushed along the inner diameter of the tube itself.
Okay, I see another problem here. Maybe there's a way around it. During an operation, I may not using the right word, extreme cleanliness is required. Any foreign materials that are introduced inside of a human being during a operation where a cavity has been opened is capable of creating all kinds of grief. So aren't there going to be extremely difficult to maintain procedures to maintain, I'm calling it cleanliness, I know there's a better word, during the procedure of introducing these wires? My guess is all kinds of foreign materials and diseases could easily be injected unless this procedure is not carried out under very well-controlled conditions. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Yeah, I would agree with you entirely, Dick. Presently, the robot, and if you take a look at the picture of the robot that supposedly does the implantation, it's like watching aliens. It's scary. But it has to be operated by a neurosurgeon, and it requires rigorous sterilization, and the electrodes have to be sterile from the get-go. So, yeah, you have to keep the field sterile. Otherwise, you introduce foreign bacteria, and you introduce a heck of a lot of problems. But even on top of that, you're introducing a foreign material. Human bodies tend to not like a lot of different types of foreign objects. One of the things that orthopedists have worked perpetually is to come up with joints that are made out of material that bodies will accept. There are some metals that they found, unfortunately, after they've tried them, the body kind of rejects them. So these foreign electrodes, you never quite know how the body is going to take to them. And what seems to be bothering most of the people watching is that they can't conceive of any kind of material presently known that will last the number of years required and be able to be stable in the salty environment of the gray matter of people's brains. And they haven't had any practical time to really test that. It's only been around for a short while. So I think that's where the problems are going to be in developing those things, not only of getting the FDA to approve this nonsense, but, the whole concept of mind melding with computer intelligence sounds, again, like Elon Musk reading his own press releases too much.
Like you, I'm repulsed a little bit by this one. I think he's gone too far. I don't think he's going to get approval. I don't think he can do this one. What he's trying to do, to put these wires and this mechanism inside of the human brain, inside of the human skull, inside of the cranium, to me is much too invasive. An MRI machine is much, much lower on its invasiveness. Functional MRI will allow you to find out what certain portions of the brain are doing, but there's a catch. Functional MRI takes a significant number of seconds to derive the data for each individual cubic millimeter, if you know what I mean. There is an article in the latest issue of Scientific American about they've come up with a technique which can now do functional MRI in a very small fraction of a second, as opposed to tens of seconds. So if functional MRI can simultaneously have the right amount of speed of evaluating each cubic millimeter or even finer portions of a brain, and can do it in three-dimensional space, I think that's a much less invasive, much nicer way of doing this kind of work, and you don't have to drill holes, you don't have to put foreign materials in there. I see more faith in that approach. Over to you, Roy, K2LIW.
I would basically agree just on safety measures, but we're kind of talking apples versus oranges. Functional MRIs are very good diagnostic tools, very good test tools. They make very good receivers for short term. You're not going to carry a functional MRI around with you all day, whereas I guess Elon thinks that you're going to have this USB-C, and eventually he'll make it Wi-Fi, and you'll just kind of plug into the Internet or something. He not only wants a receiver, he wants a transmitter as well, and he wants something small and portable. It's going to be kind of difficult to do that with a functional MRI, and you'll still end up with a receiver, not a transmitter.
There's something else I don't like here. And that is, as we go to 3G, 4G, 5G, our computing devices, portable and non-portable, connect to the Internet faster and faster, wider and wider bandwidth. That appears to be good news, on the assumption the Internet is always friendly. However, there's all kinds of mischief going on the Internet, and therefore, unless you've done heroic things to protect with firewall-like devices on your particular computer, you're vulnerable to all kinds of nastiness. So to create direct brain interface to the Internet and yet simultaneously protect it from the nastiness the Internet could create, boy, that sounds like an impossibility. I don't think you and I would go for that. The only other approach, major motivation for doing this is that for a person who is a quadriplegic, for instance, to be able to know what his brain is thinking, to get around the problem of, can't think of his name now, the British physicist real smart guy who died recently, because he had Lou Gehrig's disease. To get around the problem of the brain that cannot communicate with the rest of the body, there's a definite motivation for doing that. But are you as fearful as I am that if you get direct connection between a human brain and a very high quality internet, I think there's too many things that can go wrong? OD Roy, K2IW.
Hey, Dick, you were thinking of Stephen Hawking. That's the legitimate medical benefit of a lot of this. And they're poking electrodes into people experimentally for things like that, to be able to have people who can't move anything or say anything and be able to get across and communicate. And even the other way, people who have retinal damage and they simply can't see, they're looking into possibilities of feeding an optical image somehow directly into the brain and making sense of that, and sound directly into the brain. The problem is that none of this is practically possible simply on a technological. We don't know how the brain works for the most part. We can show a couple of few tricks, you know. We could recognize people when they hear a word that it lights up in a certain place. But that's nothing. We have no idea what the language is in the brain, what the frequency, what the channels. We know nothing. So it's going to take a long, long time, if ever, before we figure out the code of how you exchange data with a brain. So I'm not too worried initially of whether the internet's going to get into my brain under those circumstances. I would assume that they would design buffers and put it in you know, read-only memory type of things. But again, this is Buck Rogers in the 25th century. We don't have a clue how the brain works. So again, it's Elon doing what Elon does, shooting his car out into space.
WG2P with a related comment.
That's W2GP.
It's Whiskey Golf 2, Papa. Just as a quick background, I do law enforcement over at JFK, and for years I dealt with people trying to seek entry into the United States. And one guy I came across, it was very bizarre. He seemed to have like almost like a Mindy antenna coming out of his head, and I thought it was mighty strange. So I asked him about it, and it turns out he's an engineer, and also born completely colorblind. And he developed this device, which was basically a camera that interfaces directly to his brain through the rear of his head, and whatever he was pointing his eyes towards, it would give him the signals of what color they were. So he basically corrected his color vision through kind of a brain face. Now, I can't tell you how it physically worked because, you know, number one, I didn't have the time, and number two, I'm not a physician, so I don't have that background. But I can tell you it was kind of weird looking, but it seemed to work fine. Back over to you. WGP, name is Warren.
Yeah, I've got a quick question for you, Warren. From your observation of this individual, what's your guess as to what kind of visual resolution he was getting with that system? Maybe he can easily detect the fact that there's a human being in front of him. Would he be able to tell the difference between his mother and his father standing in front of him? What's your guess on that one, Warren? K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Dick, it's definitely neither. He was colorblind, he wasn't blind. So he could see clearly black and white, but he couldn't see colors. And this merged colors into his, I guess, visual cortex, but I'm not sure exactly. I don't pretend. But according to him, he now discerned the colors of the things that he was looking at, which normally would have been black and white. Over to you, Dick.
Now, you've got to talk a little bit softer, Warren. Your modulation is kind of wide. You occasionally jump out of the bandwidth of the system. Roy, Have you heard of systems like that? Over to you, Roy.
I haven't heard of that specific one. You know, they've played around with similar things. All it probably does is supply a strange sensation when his focusing device is focusing on, say, red, green, and blue, and he sort of has learned that sensation goes along with that particular color. Although if he was born colorblind, he probably doesn't have a good sense of what that really means. It's more of a theoretical construct for a person who's completely colorblind. But Eric used to regularly talk about a video, the amount of chroma resolution that the eye needs is much lower than the contrast and the monochromatic. So with black and white, you make out all the details, and it just paints a slight color. But I can sort of understand this. That's a real expensive price to just learning what colors are, I guess. But, you know, if you feel inclined to experiment on yourself that way. But, it's certainly possible, but it doesn't really translate into what you and I would think of as vision. It's not like he's seeing red when the camera is pointing at red. He's feeling some kind of a buzzing thing in his brain, and he's saying, okay, that's the buzzing I see when I see whatever these guys call red.
Yeah, Warren did say, though, he doesn't see color, but I get the impression he's seeing shape. Now, in the case of Elon Musk, I haven't been reading about him very much lately. You apparently have. Is it your impression that Elon Musk is putting 1% of his effort into this brain barrier machine, I'm going to call it, or is he putting a much bigger section of his resources into it? You have a guess as to, I hope he's only putting a minor amount of his resources into this, because it is my guess that this is going to be a very difficult path. Over to you, Roy.
The problem, as I see it, is this is one of many dubious things he has on the stove. And I think also he kind of talks other people into investing. I don't think all this money, the $187 million for Neuralink, it probably wasn't all his. I don't know for a fact. Because, you know, I mean, if he does a press release, you know, he's a wonder kid. So certainly you want to invest. You know, you want to invest in his rockets. You want to invest in his Bohr machine. You want to invest in his fire-throwing machine. And he just keeps coming up with these curious ideas.
He is something else.
Yes, indeed. And one of the worst things that can happen to a person is when they actually believe all their press releases, which I think might be going on.
Okay, somebody else was making a statement. I heard you very well, Roy. Who else was talking during that last transmission?
That was me again, WG2P, Warren. The military has helmets now, which for pilots, both helicopter and fixed wing, they can sense brain activity and, can basically take that and can that into some of the as input in some of the systems. That's totally invasive. You're not physically going through the skull or anything. It's purely on pickup points. But so I'm not sure what his thing truly provides that we're not already providing externally.
Sounds reasonable. Warren, you're going to have to cut down the modulation of that particular transmitter you're using. Portions of your speech get cut out because it over-deviates to the machine. Over to you, Roy.
Warren, think of it this way. Think of a color camera. And would you rather have a really inexpensive one that's 8 pixels by 8 pixels so you can sort of roughly, vaguely know if, say, a car is coming at you or something is really coming fast at you? Or would you rather have a 2K optical system where you could make out all the little details? So this technology, if it was really capable, would give you a much higher resolution and a higher transmission rate. So those are the benefits of something like this. rather than non-hardwired local, basically electroencephalogram probes that are then amplified through a simple, you know, amplification system and then outputted in some way.
Roger, I get that. And that does make sense. So, anyway, I've got nothing else.